All right, should we get started? So thanks everyone for coming. Very excited to see such a good turnout, and apparently there's a whole lot on the webinar as well. So yeah, should be fun. So I'm here to talk about what is data science. So give a little bit of background about who I am. I qualified as an actuary in 2011 in general insurance, was working for PwC at the time. And then in 2012, I kind of decided to move into analytics and went across to the US and did a master's of, well, at the time it was called a master of science in analytics. That was where I came across the term data science and found it was really worthwhile to put that on my LinkedIn. And yeah, since then, came back here at the end of 2014, spent a few months at Quantium, and more recently I've been at CBIG Consulting for the last year and a half. Since then, been involved in a few other initiatives, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but I'm not here to talk about myself, so yeah, we can talk a bit about data science. So here's my agenda. Going to talk a little bit about why data science, why is it important? Why are people hearing so much more about it, and why are a whole lot of actuaries interested in hearing about it? I'm going to go through a few definitions, really to kind of wade through a bit about some of the, I guess, hype and some of the things that we hear a lot about, you know, big data, machine learning, those kinds of things. There's a huge amount of, I call it fake news, I guess, out there about what AI, for example, can do and has been doing. So I want to kind of get some clearer definitions about what each of these things are, and also we'll seek to define data science. Requirements, so I guess talking a bit about what skill sets are needed to be an effective data scientist, also some of the tools. I only have a kind of small subset, but I can talk about that in more detail. As well as, you know, a lot about the mindset, which I think is actually probably the most important piece. Then I'll kind of share a few war stories, I guess, and some of the things I've been involved in, and finishing off really with how to get started. So if you're interested in learning more, where to go. And then hopefully we can have a quite lively discussion. The other thing is when I talk, I quite like to have it as interactive as possible. I know that's difficult to kind of say and expect, but please, if you have any questions, stupid questions, comments, you know, particularly anything controversial, or, you know, if you just want to heckle, that's also, will be welcome. So, all right, so let's get into it. So some of you may have seen this before. There's a really good blog out there called Wait But Why, by a blogger called Tim Urban, who's also done a TED talk on this. And he kind of talks about the state of artificial intelligence and where we are as kind of humanity, and came up with that graph, which I think is, you know, kind of interesting and kind of scary, which is pretty much saying that if we continue at our current pace, at some point artificial intelligence is going to outpace human intelligence, and that's going to kind of exponentially work and everything's going to change. And it kind of discusses the pros and cons of that, et cetera. But data science is quite intrinsic to this, so I'm going to talk a little bit about how that all fits in. But then also there's this quote around from Elon Musk, and particularly if you guys follow the news about some of the things he's been saying and his whole feud with Mark Zuckerberg, there's quite an interesting conversation around that. But this quote I certainly agree with, which is most people don't understand just how quickly machine intelligence is advancing. And, you know, working with data as we all do, it's something that's quite important, and particularly, you know, using predictive analytics. So it's certainly something to consider as we go through this talk. So why data science? Sorry, I might just lift this up so I can see it a bit better. Nope, not going to work. All right, so businesses need help making decisions in a changing competitive world. So what does that actually mean? One thing that I, you know, a lot of people often ask me to define data science. I'm sure a lot of you have been asked, you know, what is an actuary? It's that kind of difficult question that can be hard to answer in a kind of one-liner or an elevator pitch. But I find a really kind of worthwhile thing to think about is if someone asks, what is the purpose of data science? It's to help businesses make decisions, or at least it's to aid decision making. So I really want to kind of emphasize it's around making decisions and, I guess, using, call it science or proof or statistics to support those decisions. Going through this visualization here, so we've got all these emerging technologies that are frequently reported in the news or, you know, through things like conferences, which have, you know, quite a big effect on the future. So something like self-driving cars and planes, obviously going to have enormous repercussions for, you know, really across the board, but I mean, particularly in insurance, obviously, you know, we may see in 10 years or maybe a little bit more that there's no more motor books for big insurers. And I know a lot of the insurance companies, even locally, are starting to respond to that. Medicine, so things like machine diagnosis. So a lot of the recent advances in deep learning have shown images, computer vision, so being able to kind of treat an X-ray like a classification problem and actually diagnose someone automatically without having to go through the doctor. That's, you know, also quite interesting, particularly, you know, people can start doing this online. Biomedical, obviously quite important in Australia, and healthcare analytics, so also a really growing part of the economy. Neuroscience, I've actually was lucky enough to be involved in a neuroscience project where we processed a whole lot of fMRI data. So I guess looking at different parts of blood oxygen levels in the brain and then trying to figure out how that might affect someone's engagement with a particular medium. So they're watching a movie, if someone pulls out a gun, does that change? Are there any spikes that you can see? And trying to correlate that. So, you know, again, if you read the kind of Elon Musk literature and some of the stuff on Wait But Why, it's talking about, you know, brain-machine interfaces, and already, you know, something like the cochlear ear implant is something where there's a kind of artificial intelligence, human augmentation, which is actually improving people's lives. So I'm expecting, you know, to see quite a bit more of that coming in the future. And, you know, at the core of it all is data as well as science. So it's very important to that profession. Robotic process automation is an interesting one. It's something that's started to uptick quite a bit in the news. So this is really where it tries to emulate a human working with a computer. So it actually, like, controls the mouse and the keyboard and tries to automate a lot of, you know, really, you know, data entry type jobs. And so, you know, I guess some of the lower level repetitive jobs. And actually the reason I've put it there as well is I've heard, and again, not being a kind of active member of the profession, I haven't heard too much about this, but I've certainly heard about actuarial robots. And, you know, if anyone has any comments or questions about that as well, I'm interested to talk about that because I know, you know, it's something that is affecting the profession or may start to soon. The sharing economy, so, you know, your Ubers, your Airbnbs, microfinance, all of that. Again, you know, data at its core, matching algorithms. Finance, so things like robo-advisors, blockchain, again, very relevant. Education as well, so online courses. I was talking to some of the guys before about some of the courses that are available if you want to learn about data science. And, you know, all of a sudden this stuff is democratized, and it's not just, you know, you went to this top university, so you know this stuff. You can actually, anyone can learn it from the comfort of their home. And then adaptive learning, something I'm quite interested in as well, where you have, you know, someone might answer a question and that might affect what the next page is shown up. So I think even things like Khan Academy and Lumosity start to use some of this technology to improve the learning experience on a more personal level. And yeah, just about any other industry. So, I mean, I haven't even talked about things like marketing and online. You know, that's where you're seeing a huge amount of data scientists working. There was a really interesting quote, actually. I don't know who I can attribute it to, but a few years ago, someone was saying, you know, the smartest minds of our generation are working out how to help people to click ads. So, you know, that's where a lot of data science are being employed as well. So, really, I mean, you know, one thing that I've been involved in, which I'll talk a little bit about later, is in charity and social good. And even this coming weekend, we're doing a big hackathon to work out how we can use data to help homelessness. So as I say, I mean, there's really no, there aren't a lot of problems that don't, that aren't affected potentially by data and by kind of the smart use of data. So as I've said, data is at the center of all of this. Over the past few years, we've collected more and more data. So again, I mean, I was at Mark's presentation when he was talking about big data and insurance. Big data is something that's really starting to affect people more and more. There is a lot of hype, but there's also a lot of value, and there's a reason for that hype. So we're in a position to analyze this, to build products, industries, and new ways of life out of it. So skills in extracting and analyzing this data are really starting to come to the forefront, and it's a really growing industry. Does anyone have any questions about any of this or ideas? So as mentioned, I thought I'd kind of do a bit of disambiguation around some of these terms. And I mean, even I wasn't able to come up with one definition for data science, but this has been my best crack at it. So extracting valuable, actionable insights from data to support and enhance decision-making. Now that's very relevant to actuarial work as well. And I'm sure a lot of you, that definition will resonate with a lot of you. But the one that I actually probably prefer a bit more, and having a bit of an entrepreneurial mindset helps with this, which is using both data and science to create something new. And I really like the emphasis of science there. What one finds a lot in the industry is, you know, there's a lot of really interesting algorithms and things that come out and code that people reuse without necessarily using the scientific method. Which becomes really difficult when you want to prove that, repeat experiments or prove that things work. And so I think it's really important to emphasize that there's a science to it. And, you know, I use the word science broadly. I'm not saying anyone's wearing lab coats or anything, but, you know, there's something to designing experiments using statistical methods that are still very relevant in a big data age, to be able to prove the, I guess, the materiality of what you're actually working with. So data science is definitely something distinct from big data. So I've used the popular 3 V's definition. So high volume, high velocity, and or high variety of information assets that determine cost-effective, innovative forms of information processing that enable enhanced insight, decision-making, and process automation. It's a bit of a bloated definition, but really it's about the volume, velocity, and variety. So 90% of people who I speak to about big data go, oh yeah, really big data sets. Like, not really. You know, a lot of these, if it's just a case of size, but it's nice structured data, it's probably quite easy to find tools to work with. But, you know, when you start talking about real-time analytics or, you know, some non-traditional unstructured data like images, text, etc., you know, there's a whole suite of technologies that you have to use to address that. And, you know, really, again, all these different industries that I've been talking about are quite heavily affected by these other sources of data coming in. Now, machine learning, again, and I've got a graph on the next page that kind of seeks to, again, differentiate between these things. But I do find, I mean, it might be obvious to everyone in this room, but I find that there is a lot of confusion about between big data and machine learning. But machine learning is really, you know, it's about learning from data and automatically doing it. So the paradigm in the past, and particularly in the 90s, etc., as people start to really get into computer programming, was it's deterministic. So, you know, input X, output Y, and there's a path to doing that. But, you know, algorithms of which some of you are very used to, like GOMs or random forests, things like that, work in a very different way. And, you know, the more data you add and the more iterations you provide, you end up getting a better result in a lot of cases. And now with some of the compute power available, you can see technologies like deep learning where you have billions of parameters and it's just a matter of the training time to the quality of the result. You know, it's a complete paradigm shift. So that's why there's been so much attention around this. I have also kind of highlighted here predictive analytics, because I think when I talk about machine learning in that sense, it becomes this very kind of like abstract thing that, you know, maybe only artificial intelligence experts work on. And that's definitely not the case. Most machine learning practitioners are people who are, you know, I think the actuarial profession is a really good example of where you're using, you know, certain types of, in some cases, deterministic models, but usually stochastic or, you know, I guess, machine learning type models to predict things like risk, you know, premiums, things like that. So I quite like the term predictive analytics because it's a bit more grounded. And then artificial intelligence, which I've got an extremely broad definition for, which is the intelligence exhibited by machines rather than humans or other animals. And the reason I've gone with such a broad definition is because it's very difficult to define, because as soon as you start kind of putting labels on it, you're talking about a certain type of intelligence that's, you know, not really the same as what some of the things have been coming out. So there's, you know, there's a whole lot of different types of algorithms that are used, you know, robots as distinct from deep learning, as distinct from, you know, genetic algorithms and things like that. So it's, you know, it's very general, but a lot of data scientists like to say that they're AI practitioners, and that's only true in a small degree of senses. So perhaps this will make it a bit clearer, which just looks like a big scribble, but there's really some important points that are key here. So I'm going to try using the laser pointer here. Yeah. So ignore this neurocomputing. I don't know why that's there. This is quite an old diagram, as you can imagine. People don't really use the term data mining that much anymore, or KDD, which is knowledge, I think knowledge design and discovery. But if you just substitute data science for data mining here, I guess this is what I'm really trying to show. So databases, talking about things like, well, things like SQL, where you've got relational databases, tables working with each other, but also big data. And I'd make that circle a lot bigger, but again, this is I like the generality of this diagram. What I really like here is it's showing machine learning as a part of AI. So AI includes a whole lot of other things like robots and, as I say, like things like genetic algorithms, which aren't really the same as the type of machine learning that I'm going to be talking about. And again, there's a whole lot more to that industry. But machine learning's completely a subset of that. The other thing is, I don't know why it's separate from statistics. I think there is some overlap, but it is quite interesting that machine learning methods are very much within the domain of computer science, I believe. It's about optimization, optimizing towards an outcome. So it's more about algorithms and computation as distinct from statistics, which is, well, you know, what are the kind of patterns, what are the distributions, what does this fit, what kind of tests can we run over this? And I think that's something where, as I say, like, it's something that I think as we start to work with these technologies a bit more, as actuaries, the challenge is to learn more about how computers work and how to apply computer science to these problems. This is a bit easier to digest. So there's a guy called Drew Conway who came up with this definition that's been really popular. A lot of you might have seen this before. Again, I probably wouldn't define it in this exact way, but this has been a really useful paradigm that a lot of people have used when talking about data science. So you've got your math and stats knowledge, you know, which is absolutely a distinct profession by itself. But when you merge that with what he calls hacking skills, which I would call more just, you know, computer science skills, the ability to kind of program and work with a computer, you get something like machine learning. So you're able to actually, you know, use these algorithms to come, I guess, to optimize towards a certain thing that you're trying to get. So, you know, a prediction, is it, or, you know, causality or something. Then, of course, you've got your substantive expertise or domain knowledge, which is where, you know, you bring in your industry experience, something like problem definition, which I believe is the starting point for all data science. You need to understand what you're trying to solve. And so to really understand the problem, you need that substantive expertise. And when you have that, you've got data science. I don't really know what he means by danger zone here, but I guess, you know, there's enough stories about hacking that I guess you can understand what he means there. And then traditional research. So I don't know about that one either, but I guess what he's trying to say is you've got, you know, in the past we were working with small data sets and a limited set of techniques, and now, you know, there's an ability to scale that up with compute. Does anyone have any questions about any of this or disagreements? Yeah?
The danger zone is where you pretty much are...
Sorry.
is when you're coming up with insights that are not backed by statistics, so it's the sort of... the bush actuary who goes in and knows how to use a computer and knows industry knowledge, but they come up with results that are not actually backed by statistics or science or whatever, and that's why it's the danger zone, because you come up with conclusions that are not really genuine.
Yeah, so thanks. I mean, that's actually, that makes a lot of sense. I really like, there's a website called Spurious Correlations where there's a guy who just kind of makes graphs of things like, you know, the number of, I guess, potato chips bought in like this state is really highly correlated with the unemployment rate. So, you know, you can draw inference from that. And it's amazing. Some of these are like, you know, 98% correlated. So, you know, if you put that in your model and you're not really properly vetting it, you can come up with those kinds of things. I'm trying to remember the example. I read something yesterday where it was actually from The Onion, but it wasn't that clear. It kind of said that's why I said potato chips. I think it said if you buy these potato chips and they're onion flavored, then it's, you know, really highly linked to, like, it must have been jobless rate or something like that. And a lot of people were like, whoa, that's really bad. Like, you can't draw inference from that. And it's like, yeah, onion flavored, like, it's a joke. But so, yeah, lots of things like that. But the reason why I kind of was a bit confused about this is because, I mean, if you take hacking skills or what I say, computer science skills, and mix that with substantive expertise, you can still do a lot of really useful things. So anyway. The other thing people like often talk about when they see this intersection, I mean, this is a whole career path in itself, as is this, as is this, obviously, to an extent. So when they talk about a data scientist being an expert in all of these, it's like, are you kidding? You can't, you know, there's too much to learn. And that's why a lot of the time they talk about this as the kind of unicorn data scientist. And, you know, being someone who's been in the job market here and abroad, you see kind of some of the job descriptions that come out, and it's like, yeah, they're looking for a unicorn. No one can be an expert in all of these things. But in practice, generally, I find at least, and I'll talk a bit about this as well later, if you have a kind of broad knowledge of a lot of these things and the ability to kind of deep dive or go further into them as needed, that's generally what's being sought. But again, there's 1,000 different types of data scientists, so this is a very broad definition. So another part of kind of disambiguation is around what I'll call core data roles. And again, there's a lot more than this that you'll find in a good functional data team or business team, really, because most good data teams should have a clear line of communication into the business. I haven't included roles like project manager or, like, you know, in some cases, scrum master, business analyst, etc. But I really feel like the core doing roles are shown here. So, and at the company that I work at, CB Consulting, we have a lot of these types of roles, and that's how we kind of deliver projects. So, solutions architect, really what they do is work out the system architecture for these four problems. So, you know, an example is a client might come to us and say, well, we want to, you know, take our databases to cloud and be able to scale it out. And so they'll say, all right, well, you know, we need this particular AWS package, or, you know, this thing to connect them, and the data science is going to be done in R or Python or whatever. So a lot of the technical requirements, and it's a really, really noisy market. So it requires kind of being across what the latest and greatest is and what's cost effective, what scales, what the pros and cons are. And so that's actually developed into a role by itself. And as I said, you know, the rest of the development team then uses all those pieces and comes up, you know, then builds the solution. Then you got your data engineers. Now, as a data scientist, I love these guys. These are like the glue that puts everything together. You know, these are really the people who build the platform. So a project that I've just been involved with, we used Spark and Python and Jupyter and a few different things to do the data science, but that all had to live in a particular place. And that all had to work when I loaded the data in, or even having the data available and kind of pulling it into that program, I needed that to, you know, be reliable, up all the time, work quickly, you know, not kind of die because, you know, memory issues or anything like that. So it's the engineers who, you know, are responsible for that. It's kind of a fairly new term, data engineer. In the past, you know, particularly in the relational database world, you might call them DBAs or just software developers. But there's definitely a distinct role for people who work with data in this way. And yeah, I mean, the skill set can be quite broad, but SQL's also something that, you know, any data engineer will be very familiar with using. Data analyst. So I like to distinguish between data analyst and data scientist, basically because, you know, I believe a lot of data analysts can become data scientists if they want to, or can just work more on the kind of business processes. But a lot of the time it's doing things like developing dashboards, visualizations, reports, and kind of communicating the state of the world to the business. So, you know, as I said, describe what is there, what's happening, being able to visualize those insights and take the data and really turn it into business value to an extent, which I kind of does overlap a bit with data science. But it's more of a kind of doing as opposed to an exploratory role. So again, data scientists have defined more clearly as things like inferring rather than deducting, statistics, prediction, modeling, and as I've said, applying the scientific method, which I'll keep emphasizing, you know, really understanding how to set up experiments, things like test and control groups, A-B testing, all of those are the bread and butter of the data scientist. So understanding how to do that is quite key to that. And the other thing, as I've said, you know, over here, research and exploration, I think one of the difficulties often as working with a data scientist in an IT shop or a technology team is there's an expectation that by this date, you've got to deliver this and it's got to be this good, which is a very, you know, worthwhile paradigm often for building products, you know, through a usual software development lifecycle. But in data science, you really need to have the time to work out what it is you're looking for. You don't know when you start out. You might have an idea, but you need to prove that. And that can take time, and sometimes, you know, you can't quite deliver exactly what you've scoped out at the beginning. So that's why there's this kind of need to kind of give a bit of a buffer for things like research and exploration. And also because there's so many tools out there as well, you might just have the time to just work out what tool to use and how to use it. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think mindset is possibly the most critical ingredient to becoming a good data scientist. It's my opinion, but I'll try to kind of explain it as best as I can here. So, this is a quote from DJ Patil. He was I'm pretty sure he's the guy who came up with the term data science. He was one of the top, technologists at LinkedIn. And then went on to become what was called, I guess, the chief data scientist of the United States. So he was working in the Obama administration. I'm not quite sure what he's doing now, but anyway, he's developed quite a lot of the thinking around data science, and I quite like this quote here. So his first kind of flippant a little bit answer to what kind of person are you looking for when you hire a data scientist? And he said, well, someone you start a company with. Which is not something you'd really think when you're thinking about a technical role where you have to understand science and computer science and statistics. But I really like it because, you know, going back to that definition around using data and science to create something new, we're in this world where things are changing all the time, and you've got to kind of have that passion to, you know, pick up a new tool, learn a new language, work something new, and, you know, almost to an extent, like, go out to conferences, meet people, et cetera, just to kind of keep expanding that knowledge. Because, you know, I mean, there's so many examples where some models that are used today, you know, so a chatbot's a really good example. If you build a chatbot today and it's the best chatbot in the world, in 2 years it's going to be obsolete and it's going to be laughable. So if you really want to be, you know, at the kind of cutting edge, and even if you want to be effective, you kind of need to be continuously learning. And you've got to want to do that, and you've got to be passionate about it. So I think that kind of quite well encapsulates the entrepreneurial mindset as well. So this is kind of what he's saying here. You know, we're not trying to build old things. We're trying to build new things. So hopefully that's helpful. Now, this is also just a subset, really, of the skills required, and I've, you know, put that diagram in there again just to kind of bring it together. But really, I mean, I actually put the slide together a couple of years ago, so even since then, it's moved on. But I will just outline the separate areas. And again, this is by no means comprehensive, but just within the kind of computer science area or programming algorithms, you know, you've got your back and front end. So I've kind of put that out there. It's not usually a kind of core skill for a data scientist, but I know in my work, a lot of the time I've had to develop kind of web applications or visualizations using tools like D3 that you might have heard of, and in languages like JavaScript, which is front-end programming. And then you've got your back-end, which is using, you know, some of your database tools like SQL, et cetera. Programming languages, again, very general, but, you know, something like Python's quite ubiquitous, R, but then again, something like SQL, everyone who's kind of working in data science probably comes across at some point. And then in the big data space, people are often using tools like Java and Scala. So you kind of need to at least have an understanding of when to use certain languages. You don't need to be an expert in all of them. My Java is shocking, but I kind of can get through the code if I need to. Optimization. I mean, a lot of these algorithms are using certain ways to kind of get to their solution. It helps if you understand that so that when it's broken, you can fix it. But also things like, you know, just there's different problems where you'll just use an optimization algorithm in itself. So the most familiar one that we're all probably used to is something like Excel Solver, which uses a particular algorithm to kind of get to its, iterate towards a solution. A solver can actually be applied to a wide range of problems, but you know, optimization is actually a huge field and really difficult one in my opinion. But you know, it's also kind of an essential part of the toolkit. Simulation, computer science, all just, you know, around being able to build kind of good data products and good data solutions. Machine learning. I'm not going to go into detail what each of these things are, but it's the one thing that I think all data scientists probably agree is a core component of the skill set. So, you know, I haven't said at any point that you need to know all of this if you want to be a data scientist. You know, I know people who have like deep knowledge in something like physics who only know supervised learning, for example, or unsupervised learning, and they're still, you know, writing cutting edge papers in data science. But it is, I think machine learning is probably the one core thing that all data scientists agree is kind of central to that role. And within machine learning, you've got your supervised learning, unsupervised learning, reinforcement learning, which we're seeing a lot more of, deep learning, which is really a subset of all of those three, and artificial intelligence, which again is such a broad term, I'm not even going to try and define it too well. Within statistics, so my statistics skills have been getting worse and worse since I've moved away from actuarial, but, you know, just from a high level, we've got, you know, some of the statistical methods that we're used to, and, you know, basic statistics. I've kind of just put math and science underneath that, so, you know, things like calculus can often be important. Time series is really key and used actually a lot more than one might expect. And surveys and how to analyze them. So, you know, and often just small data problems. So someone asked me earlier if, you know, when working with big data, do you use like big data machine learning methods or do you subsample? And that's a really good question because a lot of people do subsample. And if you're going to subsample, statistical methods are often a lot more appropriate than, you know, highly computational machine learning methods. Visualization and reporting. Now, this is something that's particularly dear to me. I feel like one of the biggest challenges in data science is communicating results. And I think this is probably the best way to do it if you can do it effectively. So, you know, providing users or business users with an interface that they can work with interactively in a lot of cases, but allowing people to kind of explore to an extent with things like dashboards. And again, there's a whole kind of area called business intelligence, which just deals with kind of visualizing and pulling through insights in a way that people can use. To an extent, one does need design skills as well to work out how to display the information well. And communication, again, probably should underline that, because I think the ability to tell a story and the ability to communicate complex, complex theories and patterns and things to a wide audience is probably the most important skill within data science. Last bit there is data management and big data. So going back to the core data role slide that I had, you're working in a team. You're not just working with a group of other data scientists. And so you need to an extent, kind of overlap a skill set to understand a bit about, where the data comes from and how it works. So I'll go into it later, actually. I've been involved in some projects where I've just been doing data engineering roles, and that's really helped me work with those people better. But even when it comes to an advisory role, often I get asked, well, what data do we need to help with this problem? Or what other data sources are available? And, it's not necessarily a data scientist's job to get that data, but it helps to know what you can get and, to an extent, how you can go about getting it or who you should go to get it. So people talk a lot about social media data, for an example, or open data. And I feel like they're really underutilized because there's a lot of insight there, but often people just don't bother to get it. So that's something where having a bit of knowledge that can really help. Very small subset of some of the tools that are used. So I've mentioned things like R and Python. That's really like a lot of data scientists have quite heated arguments about which one's better. I'm a Python guy, but I use R sometimes. They're both great, and they're really, really good environments for working with data. Notice that most of the tools I have here, but most of them are open source. The way that the industry is currently structured, if you're working in data science, the open source tools are moving a lot quicker than the kind of vendor tools. So there are some exceptions. Again, I was talking about DataRobot earlier. They're an automatic machine learning platform. They're pretty good. Like, if you just have a clear machine learning problem and you don't have the time or the staff to kind of, come up with a really good algorithm, well, just put it through that tool and you'll come up with a pretty good result. And things like Tableau, I think I've got up there, Power BI, a lot of those visualization tools are a lot easier than, building a shiny dashboard in R or a pivot table in Excel or something like that. But open source is really where the cutting edge is. And I think it's important to kind of, if you are working with data, to have some familiarity with these tools, because sometimes there might be something that you want to try and it's only available in a particular package in a particular program. And there might not just be no alternative. So it helps if you've got an understanding of some of these things. I could easily fill the page with other tools, but these are probably the key ones. Has anyone kind of come across some other tools that they use frequently for this kind of thing? There's got to be someone. I don't think I have SPSS up there. I'm sure I've definitely seen some actuaries using SPSS. Emblem's another one I know is used quite heavily in some consultancies. And there's other open source tools. I don't know if I have like the bash shell there, different environments like Linux. There's a wide world out there. I don't think I have Scala there. So, as I was saying, around this unicorn piece, you can't be an expert in everything. Some of these areas you need a PhD and 5 years of study just to kind of start working with. So things like, deep learning is a good example, or reinforcement learning, you can just go on forever. But what I find is most useful is this kind of generalist approach where you kind of have an understanding of everything, but you're able to drill down. So an extension to that is this concept of T-shaped professionals. It's like a T-shape. So you've got a breadth of skills across the top, but there are some things that you have particular expertise in. So if you're too general, it's really difficult to get to insights when you really need to. And what really works well is when you have teams working together where they have deep knowledge in different areas, but a bit of overlapping knowledge. So that way, you know, everyone can work together to come up with the best solution. So, you know, just some points here. Data science is inherently collaborative and creative, and you'll work with a whole wide variety of people. So, you know, it's the overlapping skill sets that really helps when it comes to building a good solution. When I look at myself, I'm definitely much more a generalist. Any of those things that I showed on the other slide, I can easily have a conversation about. But when I look at my kind of where I have deeper knowledge, and bearing in mind I have a master's and not a PhD, so I don't have a particular deep knowledge in anything, I focus much more on things like big data, machine learning, and visualization. And those are the kind of the three things that I've really focused on learning more about. So, you know, it's different for everyone, but I found that that's quite a good model to work with. So data science in practice. So these are, I guess, just some stories from consulting that I've been working with. So the first thing I did as I started at CBIG was come up with we call it decision science, because we don't want to focus too much on the kind of hype around the position, really, and that it's about decisions. But we created this framework, which essentially looks at, I guess, how to solve problems and the process that we take. So starting with things like defining the problem, moving on to understanding what, you know, what data is available, how to then work with that data, so platform tools, et cetera, to the actual data wrangling, building models, evaluating the models, visualizing the output, and finally implementing it into the production system. So that was kind of just something that we wanted to put together as a marketing pack. So lots of different opinions on this in the literature, but I think we came up with something quite general. The knowledge base, so, you know, working with a lot of engineers and architects, they're also T-shaped. They're also looking to extend their skill sets. So there's a lot of kind of cross-training. You know, a lot of, and machine learning is completely accessible to everyone. So these guys who are used to working with these tools are suddenly saying, oh, well, I want to build a model, I want to try this thing. And, you know, it helps to then be able to kind of guide them in the right direction for that. So a lot of the job involved that. And yeah, training materials, which is actually quite challenging because things change a lot. The first project I started was a proof of concept, just evaluating machine learning solutions. So what tends to happen a lot in consulting, particularly in Australia, is a client will come and they've been brought along by a vendor, and the vendor said, we want you to use our software, but, you know, make it work and make it hum for this business. So in this case, the vendor was AWS, and they have a machine learning library, I think. I don't know if you call it a library, but like a package. And so my job was just to use that and show that it worked, and then to also benchmark it against other tools. So, you know, quite a broad type of project, but quite interesting working with new tools. This is the engineering piece I was talking about. So one of the reasons I joined this company is because they're really strong in big data. And I wanted to learn a bit more about the Hadoop ecosystem. So I didn't actually do any data science, so no machine learning, no visualization, no even kind of analysis of the results, but just moving data from here to here, which is probably a short description of the entire field of data engineering. So what it involved is we're working with a company it's one of the top three, I think, telcos in the world. They had, I think, hundreds of gigabytes every day generated, and we wanted to bring all their data into Hadoop. And so we're partnered with Cloudera, who are a big data company, and we just had to write the various scripts in tools like Hive and Spark, et cetera, to get it to work. So it's amazing how much work goes into moving data and just putting it in the platform to work with. So a really interesting project from a number of perspectives. This is the project I've actually been working on now. So probably a bit more common to the kind of analysis that we face in actuarial. So looking at the customer, using tools like K-means, or techniques like K-means clustering, or, you know, linear regressions, et cetera. to come up with a prediction around who to market to, how to market, and what levers to pull when it comes to interfacing with the customer in an effective way. So the company we're working with here had a big churn problem, meaning that a lot of their clients were leaving after a year or a short amount of time. And while they were really good at getting new sales, obviously it's a lot cheaper to get someone to renew their membership than it is to get a new person to join. So they were looking at reducing that, and so our job really was to say, all right, let's obviously figure out what features there are that can be used that might be predictive of churn. And this was actually really interesting because I had working with me a data scientist who did a PhD just in churn. So he had a huge amount of knowledge around this, and his key insight was, you know, we can look at how long they've been with the company, we can look at how old they are, we can look at, you know, gender and things like that, but that's not going to help the business at all, because if we show that, you know, females are churning a lot more than males, well, that's fine, you know, they might be able to somehow kind of curate their marketing to better address that, but rather, you know, the main reason people leave is because of their experience, and so if they're having a bad experience, we want to be able to dynamically find that, flag that, and then action it as soon as possible. And so we really focus on preventable churn. So, you know, a big part of this framework that I was talking about was something called feature engineering. Those of you who are familiar with machine learning know that, you know, it's not just a case of going, here's my data, here's the model, bang, now I have a result. You have to form your data into a, like, modeling data set. And, you know, so this was a customer level data set because it was a customer problem. So each row was a customer. And then we had characteristics for each customer. And some of them would be dynamic, some would be static. So age is something that's fairly static, but dynamic is like, you know, whether they've engaged with the company any time recently or what type of engagement it was or if they've gone to the website, things like that. And then you can kind of put it into your big sausage machine and see what comes out. And then see how that can be actioned and operationalized by the business. So that was quite an interesting project. I mean, churn, they talk about as being the kind of bread and butter of data science in consulting, particularly in Australia, because there's a lot of businesses with this issue, and there's a clear kind of road to value for data science there. I'm personally probably more interested in some of the more kind of blue sky things like self-driving cars, but in the meantime, while you're earning a living, it's probably a really interesting problem to look at. It's definitely an interesting problem, but it's a very useful problem to look at. So interestingly, as I mentioned, our solution was actually a linear regression, or logistic regression rather, so just doing a classifier whether or not they churned. And given all that I've spoken about, deep learning, you know, and some of the other models, random forests, boosted trees, XGBoost, some of these like really cutting edge algorithms, I didn't even try to apply them to this problem. And the reason is because of interpretability. So a lot of those models are black boxes, but here we didn't care so much whether we got the perfect accuracy on whether or not someone's going to leave, although that's important. We wanted to understand the reasons for it, so it was actually quite a different problem. And with a linear with a logistic regression, you just get a formula which just tells you, you know, which factors are important and how important, and so you can translate that quite easily back to, you know, what the actions should be and what they can try and change. So, data science in the wild is a bit different often to the kind of latest papers coming out of DeepMind. Here are some of the other projects I've been involved in. So this was actually probably my first foray, good almost 10 years ago at PwC, doing a statistical case estimate model. So very much within the actuarial realm, but looking at, so we were working with workers' compensation data. Those of you who are familiar with that, most insurance products, you've got a case estimate on the claim, but those case estimates can often be underreported or undervalued or just inaccurate. So what we thought is, well, we've got all this data that you know, is around the claim and around the customer or the policy, and we can actually start to use that to try estimate how much the claim will be. And we did that really effectively, and it was quite exciting for me because we did it all in SAS, but I'd never really done any linear regression or anything like that. And so, you know, it took us about 2 years to build, which is quite interesting in itself. But you know, the reason was because there was so much back and forth understanding how the data works, and there's so many key insights that came out that there was, again, this kind of iterative process around it. But the more I did that, the more I realized, hey, like, you know, you can apply this to other problems. So that's probably was the catalyst for me moving into a different direction. This is something that I've whipped up fairly recently. There's a company out there at the moment who are selling something similar and are doing really well. And I looked at it and I thought it's probably not that difficult to do. So given kind of the latest advances in deep learning and natural language processing, I thought it'd be quite interesting to look at the kind of corpus of English statements. So, you know, what are our top 10 customers, or, you know, where are we selling the most of our product? And try to turn that into a SQL statement. And I actually ended up not using any super sophisticated machine learning. I just used a like a word parsing tree, which is, you know, fairly simple implementation of natural language processing, and was able to kind of cover about 90% of cases that I could come up with. So, you know, not particularly interesting, certainly not anything that's publishable or would even raise an eyebrow in the data science community, but pretty cool to see that you can kind of create something that has inherent value in, you know, a weekend. And, you know, it just shows what tools are available and what kinds of things people can work on. I actually read an article last night as well, which was around, it had a really kind of shocking headline, which was like how I replicated an $86 million project with 57 lines of code. And it was actually written by an Australian who was looking at, apparently there was a project in Victoria where they had, they invested in these sensors that pick up people's license plates. And they were trying to say like, okay, well, if we can take that license plate and send it back to the central database and check whether that car has been stolen or not registered, you know, then police can do that in real time and track these people. And apparently they developed this technology that had like 400 cameras or something. So it was at a cost of, I think, $400,000 per car. And this guy looked at that and said, well, it's just image processing. And he kind of, yeah, anyway, he built a solution in 57 lines of code that was able to do that to a sufficient degree of accuracy. So that's the kind of thing where, you know, you look at it and you go, well, this technology is now democratized and available and often really accessible. You know, I don't think the author had a degree in computer science or anything. It was just a fairly simple Google, pull together various elements, and, you know, just knowing that it could be done, he found a way to do it, which I guess is that hacking skills that I'm talking about, just hacking a solution together. But yeah, I thought that was quite inspiring, and I feel like there's a lot of those solutions out there just waiting to be solved. This is actually something I did a month ago. There's a game called Breakout. Those of you who ever had an Atari kind of joystick thing where there's a little paddle at the bottom and you have to, I guess, like there's these tiles on the top and you have to knock them with the ball and catch it at the bottom, kind of a bit like Pong, but a bit more complicated. And I think it's through Elon Musk. There's a website called OpenAI Gym, and it allows people to download these programs, test their algorithms on it, and then upload them and test them against everyone else. And so I thought I'd look at this because I used to play that game when I was younger, and I wasn't very good at it, but I used to enjoy it. So I thought maybe I can teach an algorithm or a program to play it better than I could. You know, again, it was just experimental, it was just for fun, but again, quite interesting because I was able to beat my own performance on it. So it's not like we're in a Skynet or anything like that, but it's there's these really interesting results starting to come up where, you know, someone like me, who this was my first foray into reinforcement learning really, and I was able to produce something that, again, had more value than I was able to do by myself. So I don't think it was as good as like the best human at it, but it was pretty good. Differential privacy. So this was a few years ago. I did an internship at a company in San Francisco it was just a research house, and they were just looking at the kind of most interesting applications in data science, and I got given differential privacy to research and blog about. it was, again, like completely different to these other problems. It involved reading academic papers, translating them into useful words, and as I mentioned before, JavaScript and D3 to kind of communicate it in a useful way. And I wrote a couple of blog posts about this, which got some publicity, which was good. Essentially, what I had was this New York City taxi driver database, some of you might be familiar with. I think in 2013, it's Freedom of Information. They released this huge database showing where every taxi in New York picked up someone and dropped them off and what the fee was and how much they tipped, et cetera. And so I looked at that data set, and there was a whole privacy issue at the time in the press where they said, hey, the license plate that they used, they kind of ended up anonymizing it, but it was able to reverse that, and so people could suddenly see which cabs were doing which trips. And I thought, that's all, you know, that's fine. I mean, that's not great, but what would be more interesting is just ignoring that. If we just even have that information, we could probably find some passengers in the data set. And so I spent a whole lot of time Googling celebrities and taxis and looking for pictures on Google Images and found Bradley Cooper and Jessica Alba, and just showed how they had been picked up at this spot where they'd been photographed, and then I showed where they were dropped off. And, you know, not a really a big deal. But the one thing I found is, it's quite funny actually how these things get misinterpreted. Neither of them tipped. And the reason was because they paid in cash. And 99% of the time when people pay in cash, guess what? The driver doesn't record the tip. I wonder why. So, however, like celebrity gossip magazines kind of picked this up, and they were like, oh, this person earned like $20 million last year and didn't even tip their cabbie. So my name was kind of thrown around there a little bit, which was quite funny. But it was quite interesting because what I did then was show how if you applied differential privacy, which is a particularly algorithmic approach to anonymizing data, that it would have prevented that from happening. So anyway, just a completely different problem that I worked on a few years ago. And this is one I haven't actually done yet, and it's actually really simple if you think about it. But I'm working with a charity at the moment who have a database where most of their members and donors don't have information for their dates of birth. So, but they do have some. So I'm looking at just going, well, how can we estimate that statistically? So rather than get the actual exact date, or they're really interested in what kind of age bracket they fall in. So, you know, probably not a huge extension to figure out how to do that, but, you know, a simple decision tree or something like that. But again, you know, this is something where probably the value of being able to do that for that charity far strips the difficulty of the task. So I felt it was an important one to put in there because, you know, often the lower hanging fruit are the most useful things to do. So I think that's all I have there. Oh, there's one more. Yeah, this is another area of data science that I haven't even talked about. So social network visualization. So obviously Facebook, for example, have a huge like graph of everyone's connections with each other, and it's a different paradigm for analyzing data. But you know, in LinkedIn, for example, you can see sometimes they talk about influencers, or Instagram's a really good example. So if someone's got a lot of connections, they know that a certain person, if they're able to you know, advertise something, that's going to reach a whole lot of people, and they also can tell from that graph and from people's reactions that that person's an influencer and, you know, can actually sell a lot of products, etc. So that's something which is quite interesting. So I've been looking at doing that as well. I've done one project with that, and then with the same charity, I'm looking at doing that with their donor base using social media. But the one piece that I did was I just looked at my own kind of professional network and just had myself in the center and drew a graph of everyone around it. And it was quite interesting. I mean, I couldn't do a lot of useful analytics about influencers or anything, but just by having a few kind of descriptive features of each of those people, so like this person's a CEO, or this person's, you know, like I know them from school or something, I was able to kind of graph the data in different ways, which, you know, leads to extra levels of insight. So yeah, again, something just completely orthogonal to all these other things. Thought I'd talk quickly for those of you who are kind of interested in learning more. This is like very much at the 101 primer level, not in all cases, but that's kind of what it's aimed at. In terms of online sources, I particularly Data Science Weekly is something that I highly, highly recommend. I think it's just datascienceweekly.com. They come out with a newsletter every week, and it's a curated list of all the kind of latest articles within the data science world, really. And I mean, it covers a whole lot of different things. And they also have a top three, and those are also really usually interesting stories. So I subscribe to that. Katie Nuggets is also good. Data Science Central, I take most things with a grain of salt, but there are some good things in there. These books are really like a really great way to start learning some of this stuff. So going back to that Venn diagram, if you want to learn more about math and stats, but you know, in the kind of machine learning world, this Elements of Statistical Learning is a particularly good reference. It kind of goes through each of the, like, just a whole gamut of predictive models and when you might use them, and it's just a really good resource. I've got Edward Tufte's book, The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. It's like the Bible of data visualization. So, you know, no matter what type of work you're doing, if you're ever drawing graphs, it's probably good to read this. And it's quite a quick and easy read, but really useful, interesting stuff. And then Data Science from Scratch, I just like it because it's a Python-based book that just covers a whole lot of different techniques. These PDFs are a lot more accessible and easier and free. So I've actually referenced them in this talk. So What is Data Science by Mike Lucchetti's and Analyzing the Analyzers. Just quick 10-page reads and just gives a good kind of, you know, summary, I guess, of some of the trends in data science and what it's all about. Courses, so there's, I think this is up to date. Yeah, so there's a Coursera course. I think it's just called Data Science. I think it's with Johns Hopkins University. There's also one on deep learning that's just come out, which is apparently very good. Both of these are apparently very good if you want to do them in your own time at home. Otherwise, if you're taking a break, I think you can do these part time, but UTS, University of Sydney, and University of New South Wales all have master's programs in data science. And I think they're all fairly well recommended. Meetups is something that's particularly dear to me. I'm kind of one of the meetup guys in the data science community. I run three different meetups. The one being the Data Science Breakfast, which runs every 2 to 3 weeks, and we just get different speakers to come in, and it's an informal group. People just generally, like 20 to 30 people, have a chat about various different things. Recommend any of you to join. We have the Data Co-op, which is through the charity that I've been running, which is, it's like a mini hackathon where people work on different projects. And then Data Science Sydney and SURF, which aren't run by me. They're run by a guy called Eugene Dobosarski, who has, it's just an enormous community of data scientists, and it's growing. And it's probably, I mean, aside from our own meetups, the most highly recommended way to learn more about data science. They have some, you know, wide range of talks. Usually at Data Science Sydney, they'll have two talks, one like very much business focused and the other one quite technical. And you know, you'll get like 300 people rocking up every time. And then you've got SURF, which is the Sydney Users of R Forum, if you want to learn more about R. And then Data Visualization Sydney is one that I've just taken over, which is, pretty self-explanatory. So you can find them all on meetup.com. Obviously, you can find a lot more on meetup.com. But yeah, if you're wanting to learn more about data science, these are probably my first port of call. By meeting other people, that's how you really find out what's happening and what's the latest and what's most interesting. Lastly, I've got projects. So you might have heard of Kaggle. It actually was developed in Australia. It's an online platform now owned by Google that really hosts competitions. So it kind of gives you a curated data set. It says, we want to predict this using this algorithm, and you know, go ahead and try to do that in the best way possible. And it's kind of got a leaderboard and all of that and some pretty good prizes. It's a really great place for people to learn more about machine learning. And I've got Titanic there in brackets because that's their like 101 course. So it actually shows you how to step through. I think the data set is showing the survivors and people who didn't survive on the Titanic and trying to classify based on their characteristics. So, you know, those who saw the movie would know that it'd be women and children and, you know, richer people, obviously, things like that. But so like the class that they were in, but, you know, doing it in a more algorithmic way. Minerva Collective, that's the charity that I've set up. So essentially what we do is try to use data for good. And we have a range of different projects with different charities looking to use data to help. So feel free to reach out about that. We've got a community of about 400 analysts right now, so working on all different kinds of things. And also really, as I said, at the meetups, it's a really great place to network and to learn more. And then the last thing I've got there is Make One Up. So, you know, some of the things I talked about, SQL to English to SQL, reinforcement learning, you know, just like if you read something that you're interested in, see if you can try build that into something useful. That's definitely the best way to learn. I mean, everyone who works in kind of software development or programming will say the best way to learn is by doing. So I totally subscribe to that. How are we going for time? This is my last slide, really. It's just a little plug on what I've been doing. So as mentioned, on meetup.com, you've got the Data Science Breakfast Meetup. Minerva Collective, we do have more than just the co-ops, but the co-ops are an event where every month or so we meet with up to 50 people down at Stone and Chalk, and we'll split into groups, work on different projects, and then at the end kind of present back. It's not a huge amount of time to affect real change, but it's a start, and some of the projects then roll into bigger things that we can do offline and hopefully start funding soon. And then the last one is Data Visualization Sydney. So that's a group that's been kind of reinvigorated, and there's some really good speakers lined up for that. So if you're interested in that, you know, you all work with data, so it's something that's useful from a number of perspectives. So that's it for my slides. Yeah, if please lay on the questions.
Thanks for the talk, Anthony. One thing you brought up really early on and read about it is the aim of data science and analytics is to help decision-making or influencing.
Yeah.
So in your experience, maybe just have a talk about it, what's sort of a useful way to present findings, present insights, to a way to convince people to use this information or to believe that it can help them or is factual or will be replicated in the future?
Yeah. Thanks, that's a really good question because it's probably one of the most difficult parts of data science. I guess the kind of community answer would be it's around operationalizing results. So people talk a lot about data science in a vacuum where you've got, you know, probably a really smart data scientist who kind of pulls all his data from various sources, builds a solution in Python, and then kind of publishes a result. And then leaves the company or moves on to another project or something, and no one can replicate that. I'm sure we've all worked with spreadsheets like that or, you know, various other projects, and it's the worst thing in the world. And then the business can't do with it, it becomes obsolete. So I guess one answer to that question is to be able to put your solution into a kind of production system that can be maintained and replicated. So there's a whole lot of kind of tools around there, like Git, for example, so version control, you know, operational platforms working with, as I said, that overlap with the data engineers, et cetera, which allows those kind of insights to be done in such a way that comments and code is another one, just, you know, so that people can use it again. I know that doesn't directly answer your question. I think, you know, a lot of the time it depends on the problem and on the business. So as I mentioned, you know, for this client I was working with now around the churn and segmentation, we opted to go with a linear model because we knew that that would be something that's more likely for them to understand. I could have definitely built a more accurate model if I'd used, you know, a boosted tree or something. But then trying to unwind that into something that they can action would be more difficult. I might be able to say, hey, these are the top features and, you know, you should do something about it. But without actually knowing exactly how that relates to the data, then, you know, they might see results that they don't, that they couldn't use. And there was another thing that I did, which I don't know any other data scientists who have done this, but I got from my actuarial experience, which is I built a sensitivity analysis for the model. So rather than give them a big formula and say, you know, use this, go ahead, have fun, I just showed what would happen if you tweaked each of the features and what effect that would have. And then, you know, put it in a nice way so they could understand it, heat map and all that. But, you know, that allows them to kind of digest it a little bit more easily. Yeah, so again, I think the answer to that is around data visualization often and how to present data.
Here's a quick follow-up then.
just wait for the mic.
Then is it more important to spend a lot more time up front with the client or whoever comes up with the question to understand what they want or what sort of format they want the answer in or how they could use a potential solution?
Yeah, I mean, bearing in mind I'm a consultant, so that's very much the approach. But, you know, again, all this other technical stuff that I've talked about allows you to formulate the answer out of that. Obviously, not all data science problems are consulting problems, but you still need to start with something that you can understand and that you want to solve. So if you're building a new product or if you're, you know, trying to build a new search engine or something like Google have done, you know, they knew what they were trying to do, and then they worked out what the solution would be. So.
Thank you.
Hi. Can I have a question? Elaine Grace, the Actuaries Institute. So I guess two questions. The first one is just, as you said, a lot of money has been spent more on the marketing. Are you seeing a move towards government and social problems? And then the second part of that is I saw a great talk, a TED talk on weapons of math destruction, where a woman spoke about how they were basically looking at two people who had offended, and they'd use these great machine algorithms to look at the propensity to reoffend. Yeah. And of course, it was re-emphasizing all those, you know, African Americans are caught a lot, and so reinforcing all those stigmas that we have, and the ability to actually stop and look at, are there discriminations in the past that we're reinforcing by looking at machine algorithms? Just wonder, can you speak to any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something, being like a very like pragmatic futurist, I try to ignore that stuff to an extent, although I did obviously do the stuff on privacy, which was quite important. But there's a lot of examples of that. There was one where Google brought out a kind of an automatic image search, and it kind of classified black people as gorillas or something like that. And it was like, you can't have that out there. There's a friend of mine who just did a thing where he's doing automatic Trump tweets and just generating them automatically. And like, there's all this racist stuff coming out. It's certainly something that's being looked at. I was at a talk a couple of weeks ago. There was a big machine learning conference, and they had this professor from Harvard who had essentially, she wasn't trying to use the most in-depth methods or anything, but she was just saying, hey, there are all these things like this, and my whole institute is just set up to find these things and draw attention to them. As for the solution, it can be really difficult because, you know, these algorithms that are becoming more and more sophisticated, and less people are able to understand them. Yeah. And so how do you protect against this bias in these algorithms? Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's going back to simpler algorithms. In other cases, it's about kind of almost the scientific like setup of the study. So, you know, don't include something that can be misconstrued. And another thing, which is a very active area of research, is causality itself. So all these algorithms work based on kind of the effects of correlations that they find in the data. Mm. Now, that's not the same thing as saying A causes B. So, you know, again, something I don't know that much about, but it's a very active area of research. And, you know, I'm not that optimistic as to whether it's going to change for the better, but at least people are looking at it. Anyone else? Mark promised me he'd heckle me, so all right. Well, yeah, I hope that was useful for everyone. I believe the slides will be sent out as well, so please by all means feel free to reach out to me after this, and happy to discuss anything more in detail. Thank you.